She has, said I. To see the clinging of that pretty little thing to her uncle, said Mr. Homer. To see the way she holds onto him tighter and tighter and closer every day is to see a sight. Now, you know there's a struggle going on when that's the case. Why should it be made a longer one than's needful? I listened attentively to the good old fellow, and acquiesced with all my heart in what he said. Therefore, I mentioned to them, said Mr. Homer in a comfortable, easy-going tone, this, I said. Now, don't consider Emily nailed down in point of time at all. Make it your own time. Her services have been more valuable than was supposed. Her learning has been quicker than was supposed. Homer and Joram can run their pen through what remains, and she's free when you wish. If she likes to make any little arrangement afterwards in the way of doing any little thing for us at home, very well. If she don't, very well still. We're no losers anyhow. For, don't you see, said Mr. Homer, touching me with his pipe, it ain't likely that a man so short of breath as myself, and a grandfather too, would go and strain points with a little bit of blue-eyed blossom like her. Not at all, I'm certain, said I. Not at all. You're right, said Mr. Homer. Well, sir, her cousin, you know it's a cousin she's got to be married to. Oh, yes, I replied, I know him well. Of course you do, said Mr. Homer. Well, sir, her cousin, being, as it appears, in good work and well-to-do, thanked me in a very manly sort of manner for this, conducting himself altogether, I must say, in a way that gives me a high opinion of him, and went and took as comfortable a little house as you or I could wish to clap eyes on. That little house is now furnished right through, as neat and complete as a doll's parlour. And but for Barkis's illness having taken this bad turn, poor fellow, they would have been man and wife, I dare say, by this time. As it is, there's a postponement. And Emily, Mr. Homer, I inquired, has she become more settled? Why, that, you know, he returned, rubbing his double chin again, can't naturally be expected. The prospect of the change in separation and all that is, one may say, close to her and far away from her, both at once. Barkis's death needn't put it off much, but his lingering might. Anyway, it's an uncertain state of matters, you see.
I see, said I.
Consequently, pursued Mr. Homer, Emily's still a little down and a little fluttered. Perhaps upon the whole she's more so than she was. Every day she seems to get fonder and fonder of her uncle, and more loath to part from all of us. A kind word from me brings the tears into her eyes, and if you was to see her with my daughter Minnie's little girl, you'd never forget it. Bless my heart alive, said Mr. Homer, pondering, how she loves that child.
Having so favourable an opportunity, it occurred to me to ask Mr. Homer, before our conversation should be interrupted by the return of his daughter and her husband, whether he knew anything of Martha.
Ah,
he rejoined, shaking his head and looking very much dejected.
No good. A sad story, sir, however you come to know it. I never thought there was harm in the girl. I wouldn't wish to mention it before my daughter Minnie, for she'd take me up directly, but I never did. None of us ever did.
Mr. Homer, hearing his daughter's footstep before I heard it, touched me with his pipe and shut up one eye as a caution. She and her husband came in immediately afterwards. Their report was that Mr. Barkis was as bad could be, that he was quite unconscious, and that Mr. Chillip had mournfully said in the kitchen on going away just now that the College of Physicians, the College of Surgeons, and Apothecaries Hall, if they were all called in together, couldn't help him. He was past both colleges, Mr. Chillip said, and the hall could only poison him. Hearing this, and learning that Mr. Peggotty was there, I determined to go to the house at once. I bade good night to Mr. Omer and to Mr. and Mrs. Joram, and directed my steps thither with a solemn feeling, which made Mr. Barkis quite a new and different creature.
This ends side 2 of cassette 14 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 15. David Copperfield, cassette 15.
My low tap at the door was answered by Mr. Peggotty. He was not so much surprised to see me as I'd expected. I remarked this in Peggotty, too, when she came down, and I've seen it since. And I think, in the expectation of that dread surprise, all other changes and surprises dwindle into nothing. I shook hands with Mr. Peggotty and passed into the kitchen, while he softly closed the door. Little Emily was sitting by the fire, with her hands before her face. Ham was standing near her. We spoke in whispers, listening between whiles for any sound in the room above. I hadn't thought of it on the occasion of my last visit, but how strange it was to me now to miss Mr. Barkis out of the kitchen.
"This is very kind of you, Master Davy,"
said Mr. Peggotty.
"It is uncommon kind," said Ham. "Emily, my dear," cried Mr. Peggotty, "see here, here's Master Davy come. Why, cheer up, pretty, not a word to Master Davy."
There was a trembling upon her that I can see now. The coldness of her hand when I touched it I can feel yet. Its only sign of animation was to shrink from mine. And then she glided from the chair, and creeping to the other side of her uncle, bowed herself silently and trembling still upon his breast. "It's such a loving heart," said Mr. Peggotty, smoothing her rich hair with his great hard hand, "that it can't bear the sorrow of this. It's natural in young folk, Master Davy, when they're new to these here trials and timid like my little bird. It's natural." She clung the closer to him, but neither lifted up her face nor spoke a word. "It's getting late, my dear," said Mr. Peggotty. "And here's Han comfort to take you home. There. Go along with t'other loving heart. What, Emily? Hey, my pretty?" The sound of her voice hadn't reached me, but he bent his head as if he listened to her, and then said, "Let you stay with your uncle?" "Why, you don't mean to ask me that. Stay with your uncle, Moppet. When your husband that'll be so soon is here for to take you home. Now a person wouldn't think of her to see this little thing alongside a rough-weather chap like me," said Mr. Peggotty, looking round at both of us with infinite pride. "But the sea ain't more salt in it than she has fondness in her for her uncle. The foolish little Emily." "Emily's in the right in that, Master Davy," said Ham. "Look me here. As Emily wishes of it, now she's hurried and frightened, like besides, I'll leave her till morning. Let me stay, too." "No, no," said Mr. Peggotty. "You doin' aught. A married man like you are what's as good to take and hull away a day's work. And you don't ought to watch and work both. That won't do. You go home and turn in. You ain't afeard of Emily not being took good care on, I know." Ham yielded to this persuasion, and took his hat to go. Even when he kissed her, and I never saw him approach her, but I felt that nature had given him the soul of a gentleman, she seemed to cling closer to her uncle, even to the avoidance of her chosen husband. I shut the door after him, that it might cause no disturbance of the quiet that prevailed, and when I turned back I found Mr. Peggotty still talking to her.
"Now, I'm a-going upstairs to tell your aunt as Master Davy's here, and that'll cheer her up a bit," he said. "Sit ye down by the fire the while, my dear, and warm these mortal cold hands. You don't need to be so fearsome and take on so much. What? You go along with me? Ah, come along with me. Come. If her uncle was turned out of house and home and forced to lay down in a dyke, Master Davy," said Mr. Peggotty with no less pride than before, "it's my belief she'd go along with him now. But there'll be someone else soon. Someone else soon, Henry." Afterwards, when I went upstairs, as I passed the door of my little chamber, which was dark, I had an indistinct impression of her being within it, cast down upon the floor. But whether it was really she, or whether it was a confusion of the shadows in the room, I don't know now. I had leisure to think before the kitchen fire of pretty little Emily's dread of death, which, added to what Mr. Omer had told me, I took to be the cause of her being so unlike herself. And I had leisure, before Peggotty came down, even to think more leniently of the weakness of it, as I sat counting the ticking of the clock and deepening my sense of the solemn hush around me. Peggotty took me in her arms and blessed and thanked me over and over again for being such a comfort to her. That was what she said in her distress. She then entreated me to come upstairs, sobbing that Mr. Barkis had always liked me and admired me, that he'd often talked to me before he fell into a stupor, and that she believed, in case of his coming to himself again, he would brighten up at sight of me if he could brighten up at any earthly thing. The probability of his ever doing so appeared to me when I saw him to be very small. He was lying with his head and shoulders out of bed, in an uncomfortable attitude, half resting on the box which had cost him so much pain and trouble. I learned that when he was past creeping out of bed to open it, and past assuring himself of its safety by means of the divining rod I'd seen him use, he had required to have it placed on the chair at the bedside, where he had ever since embraced it night and day. His arm lay on it now. Time and the world were slipping from beneath him, but the box was there. And the last words he'd uttered were, in an explanatory tone, "Old clothes." "Parkis, my dear," said Peggotty, almost cheerfully bending over him, while her brother and I stood at the bed's foot, "here's my dear boy. My dear boy, Master Davy, who brought us together, Barkis. That you sent messages by, you know. Won't you speak to Master Davy?" He was as mute and senseless as the box, from which his form derived the only expression it had. "He's a-going out with the tide," said Mr. Peggotty to me behind his hand. My eyes were dim, and so were Mr. Peggotty's. But I repeated in a whisper, "With the tide?" "People can't die along the coast," said Mr. Peggotty, "except when the tide's pretty nigh out. They can't be born unless it's pretty nigh in. Not properly born till flood. He's a-going out with the tide. It's ebb at half after three, slack water half an hour. If he lives till it turns, he'll hold his own till past the flood and go out with the next tide." We remained there watching him a long time. Hours. What mysterious influence my presence had upon him in that state of his senses, I shall not pretend to say. But when he at last began to wander feebly, it's certain he was muttering about driving me to school. "He's coming to himself," said Peggotty. Mr. Peggotty touched me and whispered with much awe and reverence, "They're both a-going out fast." "Barkis, my dear," said Peggotty. "C.P. Barkis," he cried faintly. "No better woman anywhere. Look, here's Master Davy," said Peggotty, for he now opened his eyes. I was on the point of asking him if he knew me, when he tried to stretch out his arm, and said to me distinctly with a pleasant smile, "Marcus is willing." And, it being low water, he went out with the tide. Chapter 31. A Greater Loss. It was not difficult for me, on Peggotty's solicitation, to resolve to stay where I was until after the remains of the poor carrier should have made their last journey to Blunderston. She'd long ago bought, out of her own savings, a little piece of ground in our old churchyard near the grave of her sweet girl, as she always called my mother. And there they were to rest. In keeping Peggotty company and doing all I could for her, little enough at the utmost, I was as grateful, I rejoice to think, as even now I could wish myself to have been. But I'm afraid I had a supreme satisfaction of a personal and professional nature in taking charge of Mr. Barkis's will and expounding its contents. I may claim the merit of having originated the suggestion that the will should be looked for in the box. After some search, it was found in the box, at the bottom of a horse's nose bag, wherein, besides hay, there was discovered an old gold watch with chain and seals which Mr. Barkis had worn on his wedding day, and which had never been seen before or since, a silver tobacco stopper in the form of a leg, an imitation lemon full of minute cups and saucers, which I have some idea Mr. Barkis must have purchased to present to me when I was a child, and afterwards found himself unable to part with, 87 guineas and a half in guineas and half guineas, 210 pounds in perfectly clean bank notes, certain receipts for Bank of England stock, an old horseshoe, a bad shilling, a piece of camphor, and an oyster shell. From the circumstance of the latter article having been much polished and displaying prismatic colours on the inside, I conclude that Mr. Barkis had some general ideas about pearls which never resolved themselves into anything definite. For years and years, Mr. Barkis had carried this box on all his journeys every day. That it might the better escape notice, he had invented a fiction that it belonged to Mr. Blackboy, and was to be left with Barkis till called for. A fable he had elaborately written on the lid, in characters now scarcely legible. He had hoarded all these years, I found, to good purpose. His property and money amounted to nearly £3,000. Of this, he bequeathed the interest of £1,000 to Mr. Peggotty for his life. On his decease, the principal to be equally divided between Peggotty, little Emily, and me, or the survivor or survivors of us, share and share alike. All the rest he died possessed of, he bequeathed to Peggotty, whom he left residuary legatee and sole executrix of that his last will and testament. I felt myself quite a proctor when I read this document aloud with all possible ceremony, and set forth its provisions any number of times to those whom they concerned. I began to think there was more in the commons than I had supposed. I examined the will with the deepest attention, pronounced it perfectly formal in all respects, made a pencil mark or so in the margin, and thought it rather extraordinary that I knew so much. In this abstruse pursuit, in making an account for Peggotty of all the property into which she had come, in arranging all the affairs in an orderly manner, and in being her referee and adviser on every point to our joint delight, I passed the week before the funeral. I didn't see little Emily in that interval, but they told me she was to be quietly married in a fortnight. I didn't attend the funeral in character, if I may venture to say so. I mean, I wasn't dressed up in a black coat and a streamer to frighten the birds. But I walked over to Blunderston early in the morning, and was in the churchyard when it came, attended only by Peggotty and her brother. The mad gentleman looked on out of my little window. Mr. Chillip's baby wagged its heavy head and rolled its goggle eyes at the clergyman over its nurse's shoulder. Mr. Omer breathed short in the background,
No one else was there, and it was very quiet. We walked about the churchyard for an hour after all was over, and pulled some young leaves from the tree above my mother's grave. A dread falls on me here. A cloud is lowering on the distant town, towards which I retrace my solitary steps. I fear to approach it. I cannot bear to think of what did come upon that memorable night, of what must come again if I go on. It's no worse because I write of it. It would be no better if I stopped my most unwilling hand. It is done. Nothing can undo it. Nothing can make it otherwise than it was. My old nurse was to go to London with me next day on the business of the will. Little Emily was passing that day at Mr. Omer's. We were all to meet in the old boathouse that night. Ham would bring Emily at the usual hour. I would walk back at my leisure. The brother and sister would return as they had come and be expecting us when the day closed in at the fireside. I parted from them at the wicket gate, where visionary Straps had rested with Roderick Random's knapsack in the days of yore, and instead of going straight back, walked a little distance on the road to Lowestoft. Then I turned and walked back towards Yarmouth. I stayed to dine at a decent alehouse, some mile or two from the ferry I've mentioned before, and thus the day wore away, and it was evening when I reached it. Rain was falling heavily by that time, and it was a wild night. But there was a moon behind the clouds, and it wasn't dark. I was soon within sight of Mr. Peggotty's house, and of the light within it shining through the window. A little floundering across the sand, which was heavy, brought me to the door, and I went in. It looked very comfortable indeed. Mr. Peggotty had smoked his evening pipe, and there were preparations for some supper by and by. The fire was bright, the ashes were thrown up, the locker was ready for little Emily in her old place. In her own old place sat Peggotty once more, looking, but for her dress, as if she'd never left it. She'd fallen back already on the society of the workbox with St. Paul's upon the lid, the yard measure in the cottage, and the bit of wax candle. And there they all were, just as if they'd never been disturbed. Mrs. Gummidge appeared to be fretting a little in her old corner, and consequently looked quite natural, too. "You're first of the lot, Master Davy," said Mr. Peggotty with a happy face. "Don't keep in that coat, sir, if it's wet." "Thank you, Mr. Peggotty," said I, giving him my outer coat to hang up. "It's quite dry." "So 'tis," said Mr. Peggotty, feeling my shoulders, "as a chip. Sit you down, sir. It ain't no use saying welcome to you, but you're welcome kind and hearty." "Thank you, Mr. Peggotty, I'm sure of that." "Well, Peggotty," said I, giving her a kiss, "and how are you, old woman?" Laughed Mr. Peggotty, sitting down beside us and rubbing his hands in his sense of relief from recent trouble, and in the genuine heartiness of his nature. "There's not a woman in the world, sir, as I tell her, that need to feel more easy in her mind than her. She done her duty by the departed, and the departed knowed it, and the departed done what was right by her, as she done what was right by the departed, and it's all right." Mrs. Gummidge groaned. "Cheer up, my pretty mother," said Mr. Peggotty. But he shook his head aside at us, evidently sensible of the tendency of the late occurrences to recall the memory of the old one. "Don't be down. Cheer up of your own self only a little bit and see if a good deal more don't come natural."
"Not to me, Donald," returned Mrs. Gummidge. "Nothing's natural to me but to be lone and lorn." "No, no," said Mr. Peggotty, soothing her sorrows. "Yes, yes, Donald," said Mrs. Gummidge. "I ain't a person to live with them as has had money left. Things go too contrary with me. I had better be a riddance." "Why, how should I ever spend it without you?" said Mr. Peggotty, with an air of serious remonstrance. "What are you a-talking on? Don't I want you more now than ever I did?"
"I knowed I was never wanted before,"
cried Mrs. Gummidge, with a pitiable whimper, "and now I'm told so. How could I expect to be wanted, being so lone and lorn and so contrary?"
Mr. Peggotty seemed very much shocked at himself for having made a speech capable of this unfeeling construction, but was prevented from replying by Peggotty's pulling his sleeve and shaking her head. After looking at Mrs. Gummidge for some moments in sore distress of mind, he glanced at the Dutch clock, rose, snuffed the candle, and put it in the window.
"There," said Mr. Peggotty cheerily. "There we are, Mrs. Gummidge."
Mrs. Gummidge slightly groaned.
"Lighted up according to custom. You're a-wondering what that's for, sir. Well, it's for our little Emily. You see, the path ain't over light or cheerful at the dark. And when I'm here at the hour as she's a-coming home, I puts the light in the winder. That, you see," said Mr. Peggotty, bending over me with great glee, "meets two objects. She says Emily, 'there's home,' she says. And likewise, says Emily, 'my uncle's there. For if I ain't there, I never have no light showed.'"
"You're a baby," said Peggotty. Very fond of him for it, if she thought so.
"Well," returned Mr. Peggotty, standing with his legs pretty wide apart and rubbing his hands up and down them in his comfortable satisfaction, as he looked alternately at us and at the fire, "I don't know, but I am. Not, you see, to look at. Not exactly," observed Peggotty. "No," laughed Mr. Peggotty, "not to look at, but to consider on, you know. I don't care, bless you. Now I tell you, when I go looking about that there pretty house of our Emily's, I'm gormed," said Mr. Peggotty with sudden emphasis. "There, I can't say more, if I don't feel as if the littlest things was her, almost. I takes them up and I puts them down, and I touches of them as delicate as if they was our Emily. So 'tis with her little bonnets and that. I couldn't see one of them rough used a purpose, not for the whole world. There's a babby for you in the form of a great sea porcupine," said Mr. Peggotty, relieving his earnestness with a roar of laughter. Peggotty and I both laughed, but not so loud. "It's my opinion, you see,"
said Mr. Peggotty, with a delighted face after some further rubbing of his legs, "as this is along of my having played with her so much, and made believe as we was Turks and French and sharks and every variety of foreigners, bless you, yes, and lions and whales, and I don't know what all, when she warn't no higher than my knee. I've got into the way on it, you know. Why, this here candle now," said Mr. Peggotty, gleefully holding out his hand towards it, "I know very well that arter she's married and gone, I shall put that candle here just the same as now. I know very well that when I'm here a night, and where else should I live, bless your hearts, whatever fortin' I come into, and she ain't here, or I ain't there, I shall put the candle in the winder, and sit afore the fire, pretending I'm expecting of her like I'm a-doing now. There's a babby for you," said Mr. Peggotty with another roar, "in the form of a sea porcupine. Why, at the present minute, when I see the candle sparkle up, I says to myself, 'She's a-looking at it. Emily's a-coming. There's a babby for you in the form of a sea porcupine. Right for all that,'" said Mr. Peggotty, stopping in his roar and smiting his hands together, "for here she is." It was only ham. The night should have turned more wet since I came in, for he had a large sou'wester hat on, slouched over his face.
"Where's Emily?"
said Mr. Peggotty. Ham made a motion with his head as if she were outside. Mr. Peggotty took the light from the window, trimmed it, put it on the table, and was busily stirring the fire when Ham, who hadn't moved, said, "Marshal Davy, will you come out a minute and see what Emily and me's got to show you?" We went out. As I passed him at the door, I saw, to my astonishment and fright, that he was deadly pale. He pushed me hastily into the open air and closed the door upon us. Only upon us two. "Ham, what's the matter?"
"Master Davy!"
Oh, for his broken
heart how dreadfully he wept. I was paralysed by the sight of such grief. I don't know what I thought, or what I dreaded. I could only look at him. Ham! Poor good fellow, for heaven's sake, tell me what's the matter.
My love, Master Davy. The pride and hope of my heart. Her that I have died for and would die for now. She's gone.
Gone?
Emily's run away. Oh, Master Davy, think how she's run away when I pray my good and gracious God to kill her. Her that is so dear above all things, sooner than let her come to ruin and disgrace.
The face he turned up to the troubled sky, the quivering of his clasped hands, the agony of his figure remain associated with that lonely waste in my remembrance to this hour. It's always night there, that he is the only object in the scene.
You're a scholar, he said hurriedly, and know what's right and best. What am I to say in the horse? How am I ever going to break it to him, Master Davy?
I saw the door move, and instinctively tried to hold the latch on the outside to gain a moment's time. It was too late. Mr. Peggotty thrust forth his face, and never could I forget the change that came upon it when he saw us, if I were to live 500 years. I remember a great wail and cry, and the women hanging about him, and we all standing in the room, I with a paper in my hand which Ham had given me, Mr. Peggotty with his vest torn open, his hair wild, his face and lips quite white and blood trickling down his bosom. It had sprung from his mouth, I think, looking fixedly at me.
"Read it, sir,"
he said, in a low, shivering voice. "Slow, please."
"I don't know, as I can understand."
In the midst of the silence of death, I read thus, from a blotted letter. "When you, who love me so much better than I ever have deserved, even when my mind was innocent, see this, I shall be far away."
"I shall be far away,"
he repeated slowly. "Stop!
Emily far away.
Well, when I leave my dear home, oh, my dear home, in the morning," the letter bore date on the previous night, "it will be never to come back unless he brings me back a lady. This will be found at night many hours after instead of me. Oh, if you knew how my heart is torn, if even you that I have wronged so much that never can forgive me could only know what I suffer. I'm too wicked to write about myself. Oh, take comfort in thinking that I'm so bad. Oh, for mercy's sake, tell Uncle that I never loved him half so dear as I do now. Oh, don't remember how affectionate and kind you've all been to me. Don't remember we were ever to be married. But try to think as if I died when I was little and was buried somewhere. Pray heaven that I am going away from. Have compassion on my uncle. Tell him that I never loved him half so dear. Be his comfort. Love some good girl that will be what I was once to uncle, and be true to you and worthy of you and know no shame but me. God bless all. I'll pray for all often on my knees. If he don't bring me back a lady, and I don't pray for my own self, I'll pray for all. My parting love to Uncle, my last tears and my last thanks for Uncle." That was all. He stood, long after I had ceased to read, still looking at me. At length I ventured to take his hand and to entreat him, as well as I could, to endeavour to get some command of himself. He replied,
"I thank you, sir. I thank you."
Without moving. Ham spoke to him. Mr. Peggotty was so far sensible of his affliction that he wrung his hand. But otherwise he remained in the same state, and no one dared to disturb him. Slowly at last he moved his eyes from my face, as if he were waking from a vision, and cast them round the room. Then he said in a low voice,
"Who's the man? I want to know his name."
Ham glanced at me, and suddenly I felt a shock that struck me back.
"There's a man suspected," said Mr. Peggotty. "Who is it?"
"Master Davy," implored Ham, "go out a bit and let me tell him what I must. You don't ought to hear it, sir."
I felt the shock again. I sat down in a chair and tried to utter some reply, but my tongue was fettered and my sight was weak.
"I want to know his name,"
I heard said once more.
"For some time past,"
Ham faltered,
"there's been a servant about here at odd times. There's been a gentleman, too. Both of them belong to one another."
Mr. Peggotty stood fixed as before, but now looking at him.
"The servant,"
pursued Ham, "was seen along with our poor girl
last night. He's been in hiding about here this week or over. He was thought to have gone, but he was hiding."
"Don't stay, Master Davy, don't!"
I felt Peggotty's arm round my neck, but I couldn't have moved if the house had been about to fall upon me.
"A strange chain horses was outside town this morning on the Norwich Road, almost before the day broke. Ham went on. The servant went to it and come from it and went to it again. When he went to it again, Emily was nigh him. The t'other was inside. He's the man."
"For the Lord's love,"
said Mr. Peggotty, falling back and putting out his hand as if to keep off what he dreaded,
"don't tell me his name's Steerforth."
"Master Davy," exclaimed Ham in a broken voice, "it ain't no fault of yourn, and I'm far from laying of it to you, but his name is Steerforth, and he's a damned villain."
Mr. Peggotty uttered no cry, and shed no tear, and moved no more, until he seemed to wake again all at once, and pulled down his rough coat from its peg in a corner.
"Bear a hand with this. I'm struck in a heap and can't do it," he said impatiently. "Bear a hand and help me. Well?"
When somebody had done so,
"Now give me that there hat."
Ham asked him whither he was going.
"I'm a-going to seek my niece. I'm a-going to seek my Emily. I'm a-going first to stave in that there boat and sink it where I would have drowned him, as I'm a living soul if I'd had one thought of what was in him. As he sat afore me," he said wildly, holding out his clenched right hand, "as he sat afore me, face to face, strike me down dead, but I'd have drowned him and thought it right. I'm a-going to seek my niece."
"Where?" cried Ham, interposing himself before the door. "Everywhere. I'm a-going to seek my niece through the world. I'm a-going to find my poor niece in her shame and bring her back. No one stop me. I tell you I'm a-going to seek my niece."
"No, no," cried Mrs. Gummidge, coming between them in a fit of crying.
"No, no, Dan'l, not as you are now. Seek her in a little while, my lone Lord Dan'l, and that'll be all right, but not as you are now. Sit ye down and give me your forgiveness for having ever been a worry to you, Dan'l. What of my contraries ever been to this? And let us speak a word about them times when she was first an orphan. And when Ham was too, and when I was a poor widow woman and you took me in, it'll soften your poor heart, Dan'l.
laying her head upon his shoulder, "and you'll bear your sorrows better, for you know the promise, Donal. As you have done it unto one of the least of these, you have done it unto me, and that can never fail under this roof that's been our shelter for so many, many years." He was quite passive now. And when I heard him crying, the impulse that had been upon me to go down upon my knees and ask their pardon for the desolation I had caused and curse Steerforth yielded to a better feeling. My overcharged heart found the same relief, and I cried too. Chapter 32, The Beginning of a Long Journey. What is natural in me is natural in many other men, I infer, and so I'm not afraid to write that I never had loved Steerforth better than when the ties that bound me to him were broken. In the keen distress of the discovery of his unworthiness, I thought more of all that was brilliant in him, I softened more towards all that was good in him, I did more justice to the qualities that might have made him a man of a noble nature and a great name than ever I had done in the height of my devotion to him. Deeply as I felt my own unconscious part in his pollution of an honest home, I believe that if I had been brought face to face with him, I couldn't have uttered one reproach. I should have loved him so well still, though he fascinated me no longer, I should have held in so much tenderness the memory of my affection for him, that I think I should have been as weak as a spirit-wounded child in all but the entertainment of a thought that we could ever be reunited. That thought I never had. I felt, as he had felt, that all was at an end between us. What his remembrances of me were, I've never known. They were light enough, perhaps, and easily dismissed. But mine of him were as the remembrances of a cherished friend who was dead. Yes, Steerforth, long removed from the scenes of this poor history. My sorrow may bear involuntary witness against you at the judgment throne, but my angry thoughts or my reproaches never will, I know. The news of what had happened soon spread through the town, insomuch that as I passed along the streets next morning, I overheard the people speaking of it at their doors. Many were hard upon her, some few were hard upon him, but towards her second father and her lover there was but one sentiment. Among all kinds of people, a respect for them in their distress prevailed, which was full of gentleness and delicacy. The seafaring men kept apart when these two were seen early, walking with slow steps on the beach, and stood in knots, talking compassionately among themselves. It was on the beach, close down by the sea, that I found them. It would have been easy to perceive that they'd not slept all last night, even if Peggotty had failed to tell me of their still sitting just as I left them when it was broad day. They looked worn, and I thought Mr. Peggotty's head was bowed in one night more than in all the years I'd known him. But they were both as grave and steady as the sea itself, then lying beneath the dark sky, waveless, yet with a heavy roll upon it as if it breathed in its rest, and touched on the horizon with a strip of silvery light from the unseen sun. "We've had a mort of talk, sir," said Mr. Peggotty to me, when we'd all three walked a little while in silence, "of what we ought and don't ought to do. But we see our course now." I happened to glance at Ham, then looking out to sea upon the distant light, and a frightful thought came into my mind. Not that his face was angry, for it was not. I recall nothing but an expression of stern determination in it, that if ever he encountered Steerforth, he would kill him. "My duty here, sir," said Mr. Peggotty, "is done. I'm going to seek my..." He stopped, and went on in a firmer voice, "I'm a-going to seek her. That's my duty evermore." He shook his head when I asked him where he would seek her,
and inquired if I were going to London tomorrow. I told him I hadn't gone today, fearing to lose the chance of being of any service to him, but that I was ready to go when he would. "I'll go along with you, sir," he rejoined, "if you're agreeable, tomorrow." We walked again for a while in silence. "Ham," he presently resumed, "he'll hold to his present work and go and live along with my sister. The old boat yonder... Will you desert the old boat, Mr. Peggotty?" I gently interposed. "My station, Master Davy," he returned, "ain't there no longer. And if ever a boat foundered since there was darkness on the face of the deep, that one's gone down. But no, sir, no. I don't mean as it should be deserted. Far from that." We walked again for a while as before, until he explained, "My wishes is, sir, as it shall look day and night, winter and summer, as it has always looked since she first knowed it. If ever she should come a-wandering back, I wouldn't have the old place seem to cast her off, you understand, but seem to tempt her to draw nigher to it, and to peep in, maybe, like a ghost, out of the wind and rain, through the old winder at the old seat by the fire. That maybe, Marshal Davy, seeing none but Mrs. Gummidge there, she might take heart to creep in, trembling, and might come to be laid down in her old bed, and rest her weary head where it was once so gay." I couldn't speak to him in reply, though I tried. "Every night," said Mr. Peggotty, "as regular as the night comes, the candle must be stood in its old pane of glass, that if ever she should see it, it may seem to say, 'Come back, my child, come back.' If ever there's a knock, Ham, particular a soft knock, out of the dark, at your aunt's door, don't you go nigh it. Let it be her, not you, that sees my fallen child." He walked a little in front of us and kept before us for some minutes. During this interval I glanced at Ham again, and observing the same expression on his face and his eyes still directed to the distant light, I touched his arm. Twice I called him by his name, in the tone in which I might have tried to rouse a sleeper before he heeded me. When I at last inquired on what his thoughts were so bent, he replied, "On what's afore me, Master Davy? And over yon." "On the life before you, do you mean?" He'd pointed confusedly out to sea.
"Aye, Master Davy. I don't rightly know how 'tis, but from over yon there seemed to me to come the end of it, like."
Looking at me as if he were waking, but with the same determined face.
"What end?"
I asked, possessed by my former fear.
"I don't know," he said thoughtfully. "I was calling to mind that the beginning of it all did take place here, and then the end come. But it's gone. Master Davy," he added, answering, as I think, my look, "you aren't no call to be afeard of me. But I'm kind of muddled. I don't fare to feel no matters."
Which was as much as to say that he wasn't himself and quite confounded. Mr. Peggotty stopping for us to join him, we did so, and said no more. The remembrance of this in connection with my former thought, however, haunted me at intervals, even until the inexorable end came at its appointed time.
This ends side one of cassette 15. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
We insensibly approached the old boat and entered. Mrs. Gummidge, no longer moping in her especial corner, was busy preparing breakfast. She took Mr. Peggotty's hat and placed his seat for him, and spoke so comfortably and softly that I hardly knew her.
"Dan'l, my good man," said she, "you must eat and drink, and keep up your strength, for without it you'll do nought. Try, that's a dear soul. And if I disturb you with my clicketing," she meant her chattering, "tell me so, Dan'l, and I won't."
When she'd served us all, she withdrew to the window, where she sedulously employed herself in repairing some shirts and other clothes belonging to Mr. Peggotty, and neatly folding and packing them in an old oilskin bag such as sailors carry. Meanwhile, she continued talking in the same quiet manner.
all times and seasons, you know, Dan'l,"
said Mrs. Gummidge.
"I shall be allus here, and everythink will look accordin' to your wishes. I'm a poor scholar, but I shall write to you odd times when you're away, and send my letters to Master Davy. Maybe you write to me too, Dan'l, odd times, and tell me how you fare to feel upon your lone, lorn journeys."
"You'll be a solitary woman here, I'm afeard," said Mr. Peggotty.
"No, no, Dan'l," she returned, "I shan't be that. Don't you mind me. I shall have enough to do to keep a bee-in for you."
Mrs. Gummidge meant a home.
"Again you come back to keep a bee-in here for any that may hap to come back, Dan'l. In the fine time I shall sit outside the door as I used to do. If any should come nigh, they shall see the old widder woman true to him a long way off." What a change in Mrs. Gummidge in a little time. She was another woman. She was so devoted, she had such a quick perception of what it would be well to say and what it would be well to leave unsaid. She was so forgetful of herself and so regardful of the sorrow about her that I held her in a sort of veneration. The work she did that day. There were many things to be brought up from the beach and stored in the outhouse, as oars, nets, sails, cordage, spars, lobster pots, bags of ballast and the like. And though there was abundance of assistance rendered, there being not a pair of working hands on all that shore but would have laboured hard for Mr. Peggotty and been well paid in being asked to do it, yet she persisted all day long in toiling under weights that she was quite unequal to, and fagging to and fro on all sorts of unnecessary errands. As to deploring her misfortunes, she appeared to have entirely lost the recollection of ever having had any. She preserved an equable cheerfulness in the midst of her sympathy, which was not the least astonishing part of the change that had come over her. Querulousness was out of the question. I didn't even observe her voice to falter or a tear to escape from her eyes the whole day through until twilight, when she and I and Mr. Peggotty being alone together, and he having fallen asleep in perfect exhaustion, she broke into a half-suppressed fit of sobbing and crying, and taking me to the door, said, "Ever bless you, Master David, be a friend to him, poor dear." Then she immediately ran out of the house to wash her face, in order that she might sit quietly beside him and be found at work there when he should awake. In short, I left her, when I went away at night, the prop and staff of Mr. Peggotty's affliction, and I couldn't meditate enough upon the lesson that I read in Mrs. Gummidge and the new experience she unfolded to me. It was between 9 and 10 o'clock when, strolling in a melancholy manner through the town, I stopped at Mr. Omer's door. Mr. Omer had taken it so much to heart, his daughter told me, that he'd been very low and poorly all day and had gone to bed without his pipe. "A deceitful, bad-hearted girl," said Mrs. Joram. "There was no good in her ever." "Don't say so," I returned. "You don't think so." "Yes, I do," cried Mrs. Joram angrily. "No, no," said I. Mrs. Joram tossed her head, endeavouring to be very stern and cross, but she couldn't command her softer self, and began to cry. I was young, to be sure, but I thought much the better of her for this sympathy, and fancied it became her as a virtuous wife and mother very well indeed.
"What will she ever do?" sobbed Minnie. "Where will she go? What will become of her? Oh, how could she be so cruel to herself and him?"
I remembered the time when Minnie was a young and pretty girl, and I was glad that she remembered it too, so feelingly.
"My little Minnie," cried Mrs. Joram, "has only just now been got to sleep. Even in her sleep she's sobbing for Emily. All day long little Minnie's cried for her and asked me over and over again whether Emily was wicked. What can I say to her when Emily tied a ribbon of her own neck round little Minnie's the last night she was here, and laid her head down on the pillow beside her till she was fast asleep? The ribbon's round my little Minnie's neck now. It ought not to be, perhaps, but what can I do? Emily's very bad, but they were fond of one another, and the child knows nothing."
Mrs. Joram was so unhappy that her husband came out to take care of her. Leaving them together, I went home to Peggotty's, more melancholy myself, if possible, than I had been yet. That good creature, I mean Peggotty, all untired by her late anxieties and sleepless nights, was at her brother's, where she meant to stay till morning. An old woman who had been employed about the house for some weeks past, while Peggotty had been unable to attend to it, was the house's only other occupant beside myself. As I had no occasion for her services, I sent her to bed, by no means against her will, and sat down before the kitchen fire a little while to think about all this. I was blending it with the deathbed of the late Mr. Barkis, and was driving out with the tide towards the distance at which Ham had looked so singularly in the morning, when I was recalled from my wanderings by a knock at the door. There was a knocker upon the door, but it was not that which made the sound. The tap was from a hand, and low down upon the door, as if it were given by a child. It made me start as much as if it had been the knock of a footman to a person of distinction. I opened the door, and at first looked down, to my amazement, on nothing but a great umbrella that appeared to be walking about of itself. But presently I discovered underneath it Miss Mocha. I might not have been prepared to give the little creature a very kind reception if, on removing the umbrella, which her utmost efforts were unable to shut up, she had shown me the volatile expression of face which had made so great an impression on me at our first and last meeting. But her face, as she turned it up to mine, was so earnest, and when I relieved her of the umbrella, which would have been an inconvenient one for the Irish giant, she wrung her little hands in such an afflicted manner that I rather inclined towards her. "Miss Mocha," said I, after glancing up and down the empty street without distinctly knowing what I expected to see besides, "how do you come here? What's the matter?" She motioned to me with her short right arm to shut the umbrella for her, and passing me hurriedly went into the kitchen. When I closed the door and followed with the umbrella in my hand, I found her sitting on the corner of the fender. It was a low iron one with two flat bars at top to stand plates upon, in the shadow of the boiler, swaying herself backwards and forwards, and chafing her hands upon her knees like a person in pain. Quite alarmed at being the only recipient of this untimely visit, and the only spectator of this portentous behaviour, I exclaimed again, "Pray tell me, Miss Mocha, what's the matter? Are you ill?" "My dear young soul," returned Miss Mocha, squeezing her hands upon her heart one over the other, "I am ill here. I'm very ill. To think that it should come to this, when I might have known it and perhaps prevented it if I hadn't been a thoughtless fool." Again, her large bonnet, very disproportionate to her figure, went backwards and forwards in her swaying of her little body to and fro, while a most gigantic bonnet rocked in unison with it upon the wall. "I'm surprised," I began, "to see you so distressed and serious," when she interrupted me. "Yes, it's always so," she said. "They're all surprised, these inconsiderate young people, fairly and full grown, to see any natural feeling in a little thing like me. They make a plaything of me, use me for their amusement, throw me away when they're tired, and wonder that I feel more than a toy horse or a wooden soldier. Yes, yes, that's the way. The old way." "It may be with others," I returned, "but I do assure you it's not with me. Perhaps I ought not to be at all surprised to see you as you are now. I know so little of you." I said without consideration what I thought. "What can I do?" returned the little woman, standing up and holding out her arms to show herself. "See what I am. My father was, and my sister is, and my brother is. I've worked for sister and brother these many years. Hard, Mr. Copperfield, all day. I must live. I do no harm. If there are people so unreflecting or so cruel as to make a jest of me, what's left for me to do but to make a jest of myself, them, and everything? If I do so for the time, whose fault is that? Mine?" "No, not Miss Mocha's," I perceived. "If I'd shown myself a sensitive dwarf to your false friend," pursued the little woman, shaking her head at me with reproachful earnestness, "how much of his help or goodwill do you think I should ever have had? If little Mocha, who had no hand, young gentleman, in the making of herself, addressed herself to him or the like of him because of her misfortunes, when do you suppose her small voice would have been heard? Little Mocha would have as much need to live if she was the bitterest and dullest of pygmies, but she couldn't do it. No! She might whistle for her bread and butter till she died of air." Miss Mocha sat down on the fender again, and took out her handkerchief and wiped her eyes.
"'Be thankful for me, if you have a kind heart, as I think you have,' she said, "'that while I know well what I am, I can be cheerful and endure it all. "'I'm thankful for myself, at any rate, that I can find my tiny way through the world "'without being beholden to anyone.'